Hey, what's going on? Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. No Blue Jays baseball yesterday, but no shortage of fun stuff around the league, around the sports world. Julia, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I use the off day to do what I always do, which is watch baseball. I watched the Yankees lose in 11 to the Angels. It's been a weird stretch for this division, Blake, which is good news for the Blue Jays, because they're not losing that much ground here, even if they're losing three in a row and then off the next Monday.
And yes, not losing ground to the Yankees specifically. However, the Rays have won four in a row and the Red Sox have won six in a row. Both of those teams won last night. So if you are looking at the overall competitive landscape, you are getting in thicker weeds here. Yeah. If you had taken one or two off the Phillies, you would feel better about things. The division gap would be closing. And wouldn't you know it, as the Diamondbacks are here, the AL East has turned into the NL West as it's supposed to be. All three wildcard spots would belong to the American League East if the season ended today. It is, of course, very early. But yeah, Yankees lose. Sox keep rolling without Rafael Devers and do a press conference that we'll talk to a Sox person about this sometime later when we revisit the trade. The reporting, and this is from June Lee, among other people. Mm-hmm. So June's been on the show with us. He wrote something for Yahoo yesterday, coming out of the Red Sox stuff. Allegedly, not only was there a public Zoom with Craig Breslow and company, there was an internal one that the mics were not off as soon as everyone thought. And there was a lot of internal strife being revealed based on leaks from that meeting, which is really
interesting. This is amazing. We'll keep our eyes peeled. Yeah, talk all of it.
We're going to talk more Devers before the season's over, more Sox before the season's over, surely. Shohei Ohtani also made his pitching debut last night. We're going to talk about that a little later. We got Dan Zimborski coming on today, Anthony Castrovitz. We'll talk to Steve Berthume, the Diamondbacks play-by-play guy, because the Blue Jays host the Diamondbacks for three starting tonight, Chris Bassett against Brandon Pfaadt. But right now, we're joined from a very nice-looking location by Sportsnet insider Shai Davidi. Shai, what's up, man? Thanks for doing this, and this is a wonderful backdrop.
Thank you. Yeah, it's taking advantage of the little summer weather out on the patio and trying to enjoy the our summers, which always feel too short.
It's true.
And what do we got? Is that a North York baseball hat? What's the Okay.
Nice. North Toronto.
Oh, we love
where my
that.
Son plays. There we go.
How's their season going so far?
Let me see. They're a tick over 500. I think they're probably better than they've shown. But they're kids playing baseball and learning their way. So they're having fun, which is the most important thing.
Yeah, I can imagine it's a little up and down. I was actually talking to John Axford about it the other day. So he coaches both of his kids, who are, I think, 12 and 14. And yeah, the ups and downs of, like, they're figuring it out, eureka, and then, oh no, they're 12-year-olds has got to be interesting.
Nothing is linear in any level of this sport.
Yes. Okay, let's go from very young baseball players to one of the oldest baseball players in the majors, Max Scherzer. You were down in Buffalo on Friday for that. Before we get into the specifics of Max, how was that? Like, we were talking last week, going to Salem Field is a blast. It's a really fun spot to watch a game. How'd you enjoy the trip down?
I always have a good time at that park, visiting with players. They have a great environment. When the weather's good, the fans come out, and it's pretty fun. It's a pretty fun place to watch a baseball game. And, you know, the Bisons, even though their record isn't probably what everybody in Buffalo would hope it would be right now, they have some fun players there right now. They're that depth layer for the Blue Jays that, you know, they've wanted to have is clearly there. They've got a lot of players who could in a spot come up, and maybe one of them do what, say, Addison Barger has managed to do for them so far this season. So definitely enjoyed that trip to Buffalo.
Did you get a friendship bracelet? It was friendship bracelet night there, and there was Taylor Swift playing at every break and play. They didn't give media friendship bracelets?
I mean, I didn't, so maybe that tells you about my standing there with the Bisons. But no, I didn't even realize that. I was pretty locked in on my task there that day.
Yeah, it was a pretty big task, I will say, to sort of watch a Hall of Famer pitch.
Yeah, there's a gap in professionalism here between you and I, Shai.
I also spent 3 hours driving there because the traffic was really bad. So I was a little behind in my planning schedule, trying to get all the stuff that I wanted to get accomplished there too. So I wasn't exactly in scramble mode, but I was definitely in lock it in and get it done mode.
Yeah, not exactly in friendship mode. let's put it like that. But let's talk about Max Scherzer then. How did he look to you? I know that we're not necessarily looking for results here, but the velo seemed okay. What were your impressions there, Shai?
Yeah, I mean, got up to 94, was sitting 92, which is kind of where he generally is. And if he's there, he had success, executed some good pitches, left one, I believe it was a sinker up that ended up getting hit for a home run, but otherwise was in pretty good command. And I think the key thing is that he got the fifth up. He had kind of been maybe a little bit too efficient to hit his pitch count through four innings. So he came back out for one batter in the fifth, ended up with a three pitch strikeout, and that ended his outing. But as always with him, it's how do you feel the next day and are you able to go the next time out? And it seems to be all systems go. And that's scheduled for Wednesday at Worcester. And this is going to be on regular rest, too. So this is a pretty good test to kind of see if he can roll with what the routine is going to be. I'm guessing they're going to target about 75, 80 pitches in that outing. And at that point, if it's all systems go, I think the Blue Jays are going to start getting closer to having to make a decision. Is it one more after that? Is it back to the Blue Jays after that? I think they'll both be on the table depending on how he emerges from the next outing.
So you, in your piece for sportsnet.ca, and you talked to Max after the game, and obviously on Friday night, you don't have the benefit of seeing how he'll recover and bounce back, but we heard the side session on Sunday went as well as you'd hope, and he felt pretty good and things like that. So in the quote that Scherzer gave you, he says, you know, we'll all have a conversation, like we'll talk with the team and stuff like that. In your sense of it, though, is this... given how long Scherzer's been around, how well he knows his body, if he comes out of Wednesday and kind of says, I'm good to go, is that like 80, 90% of what we're looking for here?
That's definitely a big part of it. There will be some, more objective inputs into that too, whether, are his pitches where they need to be? Is his recovery where he needs to be? Is his strength kind of where it needs to be? All the boxes that you would need to check from an objective health standpoint. So as long as those are clear and then that matches up with what he's feeling, then I think that would be the final point that allows him to tip the scales one way or the other.
And then I guess the question is, and then what, right? Because this rotation still has more question marks here with Bowden Francis, who seemed to take a step back until the command was kind of lost in that start against the Phillies. But yeah, what do you make of where the Blue Jays rotation is right now, Shai, and more specifically of the decision to keep rolling with Francis here?
Well, I think right now, I think there are two elements at play. One, the Blue Jays do believe that he's making progress, and whether that shows up on the mound or how much it shows up on the mound, we've seen some variance there. But the other element to this is, what are your alternatives? And the Blue Jays haven't really had alternatives, and you're already running one bullpen game in your rotation. And as much as that's been taxing, the Blue Jays have done well with it. And it's kind of funny. This, we've talked about it, but I don't know that we acknowledge it enough. Like, this could have really capsized their season if it hadn't gone as well. Eric Lauer's emergence and the job that he's done probably does not get enough credit, given how important it has been to really hold the pitching staff together. And they've won the majority of those starts in Scherzer's absence. So not only did you manage to kind of keep the staff going, you've also managed to turn it into a competitive advantage. Now, there's a cost to that, and Bowden Francis might be some of the cost of that. You've seen them make an adjustment in the way the rotation was set up because they wanted to make sure that they were able to put Kevin Gausman in and around that, and have Chris Bassett going into that bullpen game. So you have the guy, your couple of your workhorses buffeting some of the effects of those 2 days. But something's got to give there. This is unsustainable longer term. I think the Blue Jays have really been fortunate to get away with it for as long as they have to this point. And I think that trying to fix one of those two situations will be the priority. And when you fix one, now you have a little bit more depth to fix the other as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. We get the question in the text line or the mailbags all the time. Why isn't Francis out of the rotation? What about if it happens again next start? And yeah, if there were someone ready to go, that would maybe be a different conversation. But there's not. And even like Easton Lucas, if you want to, he's on the IL now at AAA. So there's nothing until Scherzer is ready or Spencer Turnbull is stretched out. Obviously, Eric Lauer, like you said, the bullpen days have been pretty successful. I think, what did I say last week? 7-2?
That's right.
In bullpen days. And Eric Lauer has been a big part of that. Do you think there would be an appetite? Like, let's say Scherzer comes back and Bowden Francis still continues to struggle. I know you've said they think he's making progress, but would there be an appetite for Lauer's just a starter now, or do they like the kind of flexibility using him in bulk and having him available on a non-start day out of the bullpen? Like, is that too valuable a piece right now?
Well, I do know there are some people who are advocating for that, and then there some of it is determined by the usage leading into the bullpen, into the bullpen day. Some of it is matchup. And, you know, if you can take out a couple right-handed hitters at the beginning and then give them a better entry point in the second or third inning or whatever the case may be, then you can do that. Or if you're trying to force the other team to flip some hitters in the middle of the game, there's a lot of strategy that goes into how they use Eric Lauer. But I think on the surface, if you just look at the performance, you say, yeah, like, you know, this guy might merit just a turn every fifth day. But there have been a couple of occasions where they've used him in between those games. And you think back to, a couple of weeks ago here when Philadelphia blasted Francis in that first game and Lauer comes in and gives him four shutout innings of relief. And without those four innings, the Blue Jays pitching staff might not have been in position to help the team win the next two games the way that it did. And then he was back on the mound Friday in Minnesota. So some of the flexibility that he offers has values outside of a start every 5 days. But with another steady starter there, the Blue Jays simply have more options and more depth, which they currently do not have.
I think we kind of maybe hoped that Spencer Turnbull would fill that role in some capacity here, Shai. No one expected him to give you, you know, six scoreless innings each time. But the prospect, I guess, when he was signed was that maybe he would work his way to the rotation. Blue Jays haven't seemed very willing to use him in that way. We have also seen him kind of slide into different spots there with fewer than 5 days in between. Let's say it like that. What have you made of him so far? And in your mind, I know it's a small sample size, but what is the ideal usage for a guy like Turnbull?
I think the initial thought was that he would come up and slide right into the rotation, into that spot that Max Scherzer had vacated on the IL. But as he was building up, the impression seems to be that he just simply needed a little bit more time than the 35-day option period that he had in his contract. So as he returned, it was, okay, well, this option period is up. He's got to be up in the big leagues. And let's put him into the position where he can still get some bulk innings, continue to work on his arm, continue to get that back into shape, and then see where it leads. So he both started and relieved very effectively for the Phillies last season. And the Blue Jays want to try to help him get back to that point. And if it's in a swing role, then at this point, the Blue Jays will take the bulk innings where they can get them, because there's certainly a need for that. And where it goes will be determined by two things. You know, does his stuff tick up as he's able to pitch a little bit more and get better into game action? And then two, where does the need end up landing?
So Turnbull, Scherzer, Bowden Francis, Eric Lauer. We can throw Adam Macko in there. He's made two starts back at AAA, although the last one didn't go that well. That is a lot of question marks for two rotation spots. Now, the Blue Jays have about 6 weeks to see what sticks with this. I say 6 weeks because the trade deadline is 6 weeks and a day or two away. How important do you think it is to get a sense of which of these guys can stick and can stretch out over the next couple weeks? Because we entered the season, I think everyone thought, well, every team needs bullpen help and the Jays will probably want a bat. And the way things have played out now, if the deadline were today, we'd be saying absolutely starter is the top priority. So how closely do you think, or I guess how closely are you monitoring how these next couple weeks go in terms of what the shopping list is going to look like in, you know, a month from now?
Yeah, I think they're vital, right? And, you know, one name you did mention is there's Alek Manoah on the horizon in maybe August at some point, maybe August, early September, depending on how his rehab continues. But I think there are two factors, right? And again, it's still early. We're still in the middle of June, but there are so many teams in it that the availability in the market is going to be one factor. And so if you can get better impact in one area as opposed to another, maybe that supersedes some of your needs. But I think the Blue Jays have to make the determination, okay, what's going to be sustainable for us in this pitching staff? You know, Barrios, Gausman, Bassett, you know, full credit to them. They have absolutely held this rotation together with their consistency and providing innings, and they're going to need some support. And, you know, is it coming? Is Scherzer able to take a regular turn without issue? Can Bowden Francis correct enough to build a little bit of a role and just give them, again, steady innings? It doesn't, you know, I think his September last year, August, September, distorted some people's views perhaps, and thinking that they were going to get a, you know, a guy taking a no hitter into the ninth every other start, clearly not sustainable and not realistic. But can he just, you know, be a guy who gives you five innings at a 4.25 ERA? You know, I think that would be plenty for the Blue Jays. So do you have that? And if not, then maybe you elevate starting rotation a little bit. But if you're going to get better impact out of a reliever, if you're going to get better impact out of a bat, then maybe you're diverting your resources there. And then what's going to be on the market? And so I think at least right now, in the conversations I'm having, that, you know, teams are really thinking about the scarcity of what might be on the market and how that may impact some of their shopping. Lots of time for that to change. Lots of time for teams to decide, yeah, we're not really in this. We better make a move. But as you're looking at it right now, you know, the standings are still relatively clustered enough that it's definitely going to be a seller's market. And I think that's going to impact how teams make some of their decisions.
Well, sweep the Diamondbacks so that they're closer to being sellers, because they've got two pending free agent starters. Yeah, there you
can go. Help your own cause a little bit here. But, and then you also look at the offensive side, right, Shai, and the fact that it has been pretty much a roller coaster up to this point. They're either producing like crazy, or we see what we saw in Philly, which is kind of a lot of nothing here. And that's also probably going to impact how the Blue Jays look at the trade deadline. What are you seeing from Vlad and Bo here? Because there's a lot of just average, right? And we know that they're streaky. We know it might be a little bit difficult to sort of quantify their season up to this point. Is it time to maybe raise a little bit of a flag here?
I don't know if it's time to raise a flag there. I think the way that I'd look at it is, you know, both those guys are still going to get to their numbers, right? And so if you're thinking about how the Blue Jays have gotten here, and, you know, their recent surge of success has really come on the backs of a lot of spots elsewhere in the lineup that you weren't necessarily counting on. And eventually those two guys are going to get into the mode where they're carrying the club, and Anthony Santander is going to come back at some point and hit 15 home runs. And you're going to get some production from the guys that you were expecting to do the heavy lifting. And the fact that the Blue Jays are in this spot without those guys going full airship carrier mode yet, I think that's great for the Blue Jays, because you're still counting on that to come. And so, you know, I think for both Bo and Vlad, I mean, Bo is still leading the team in RBIs out of the leadoff spot, which is not something that you'd necessarily expect to see. Vlad has been getting on base and driving in runs and working with what pitchers are offering him, as opposed to trying to force the issue. And I think that's a good sign if you're the Blue Jays. So, you know, I still think all that production is to come from those guys. You trust that it's going to be there because they're both so immensely talented. And that, for the Blue Jays, is something that you look at and say, okay, this is going to get us through. Because, again, that's the talent level that you're speaking of with those two guys.
All right, I want to go a couple quick hits with you before we let you go and enjoy your beautiful backyard morning here, Shai. I don't know when your next minor league notebook is coming, but those are indispensable for us and for every Blue Jays fan. You haven't written about it yet. I assume it's coming. But Treya Savage getting the aggressive bump to Double-A looked pretty good in his first one outside of the shaky command. The first three batters really settled in there. What do you make of the speed with which the Blue Jays went high A and then right to Double-A, and what they're trying to accomplish with, you know, testing you, Savage, pretty quickly with that?
So two things. One, I mean, he's just simply been better, far better than the competition he's faced at that point. And he got to the point where he's not developing at that point. So the start in Dunedin was weather related. They wanted to make sure that he was getting his outings in every time. He wasn't in the cold weather early in Vancouver and dealing with rainouts. And, you know, they had a bunch of those. So that was important. And now Double A, this is the first time he's going to be tested a little bit against, you're going to get a lot of the sort of the game's top prospects who are pushing through. And they're going to take a look at sort of how that face is there and then make a determination. To me, the most interesting thing so far is how they've really limited his pitch count to roughly 60 to 70 pitches per outing thus far. And to me, that's a pretty deliberate sign that they're trying to save innings for him into August and September. What does that mean? Does that mean they're going to come with the Blue Jays? You know, that's not necessarily true, but it's clear they want to at least give themselves the option to have that on the table and for him to have workload left and be still be fresh at that point down the road.
Which is really exciting. Yeah. You know, obviously a guy who was a first round pick last year, you're not going to hotshot him to the major league bullpen in September unless he's ready and you need it. But the Blue Jays are going to be in playoff push. You know, Jackson Job comes to mind from last year, the way the Tigers used him down the stretch. Now, obviously, that has not turned out as well this year, but those things happen. So it's pretty fascinating to, you know, I kind of assumed that was a part of it, of, you know, the innings and pitch count wise. And four starts at high A is enough instead of seven or eight, because like let's keep moving him up and just see how he responds. And I'd imagine, too, there's an element of, well, he hadn't really struggled at any point in A or high A. And you kind of want to see that at some point to see how he'd bounce back and adjust. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was just above the level of play. Yeah. Right. And that when a guy is too good for a level, it's like, you're just wasting his time there at a certain point. So you want a player to be challenged. You know, I think about Arjun Namala and conversation I had with him in the spring. And he was like, you know, I know the Blue Jays got some criticism for assigning me to Dunedin last year. He's like, but I wanted that challenge and I want the challenge of Vancouver this spring, which the Blue Jays ultimately gave to him. And, you know, I think that's someone probably in July at some point, maybe after the All-Star break, we'll see him get a bump as well. As long as he continues to perform, which he certainly shows a little sign of slowing down. So I think when a player gets to the point that he's not learning anything from the competition that he's facing, that's the time to promote him.
Anything else coming in the next notebook of no? I know you tweeted about Landon Mirautis recently. Brandon Barriera's back in FCL games. Can you give us a little tease as what's dropping in the next notebook?
Well, I'll tell you some things that I'm sort of monitoring right now. Like RJ Schreck is really interesting at Buffalo, and Yohendrick Piñango as well, two outfielders who the Blue Jays acquired last year. And, you know, part of right now, it's like you're looking both at development and also asset watch because, you know, the Blue Jays are in a position where they look like they're going to be adding and everything's going to be on the table, right? So I think those are interesting. I had a good chat with Will Wagner, who, you know, hurt his foot after he'd gotten sent down. Actually, pretty brutal. He was telling me that he fouled the ball off so hard off his foot that it actually left a groove in the bone. And so he's recovered from that, finding his way. Had a nice game Friday while I was there, including a game tying double in the ninth inning. Might have been a walk off hit if it hadn't ground ruled and hopped over the fence. But you know, he seems to be finding his way, and that's an interesting development for the Blue Jays, since you know that was someone that the Blue Jays were really counting on to be a big part of their offense. And I'm not sure what to read into this, but I saw Aurelvis Martinez taking some ground balls at first base with first baseman's mitt. Mm. So he hasn't played there yet, so it's still been mostly second and a bit of third. But I'm wondering if that's something that the Blue Jays might be looking at for down the road a little bit.
That's such a fascinating one, because like obviously the defense at third and short was not good enough, and that's why he moved to second base. And I mean, I'm sure the idea of a corner outfield would be kicked around if like the seven best prospects in the system at the major league and AAA and AA level weren't all outfielders. Maybe that would get kicked around. That's a really interesting one, Shai. That's pretty fascinating.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that for sure. And you know, just before we let you go, because it's sort of I was thinking about it while you were talking there, Shai. How do you, in your experience, how have you seen the Blue Jays sort of weigh or evaluate future talent for this club versus potential trade assets when it comes to these, you know, AAA guys, maybe guys who are somewhat ready to make their debuts or whatever?
Well, there are two sort of factors into that. One, it's, you know, what are you getting in return, potentially getting in return, right? And then two, sort of where are your needs? I think if you're looking right now, the Blue Jays have an immense surplus of outfielders. And we've been talking about this since spring training when, you know, they carried all the extra outfielders. And that's where the bulk of their talent is. I think if you're just looking at it from a 40-man perspective and an organizational perspective, it's, let's see if we can maybe balance that out a little bit in a couple of other areas. So I think that's one piece of it. And then the other is like, well, what are you projecting that player's longer term role as? So their longer term projections will factor into that. How are they fitting into the puzzle? You know, I hesitate to use the word untouchable, but, you know, it was only a couple of years ago we were thinking, okay, there's no way Austin Martin and Simeon Woods Richardson are going anywhere. And suddenly they're gone at the trade deadline for Jose Berríos. But I have trouble envisioning a scenario where Trey Savage or Arjun Amala end up in a deal. And those, I think, are two players the Blue Jays are looking at as very important parts of their longer term future. Ricky Tiedemann as well. And, you know, he's obviously behind some of the other guys that you mentioned, Blake, but they're coming down the road. So I think all those factors get thrown together. And, you know, the Blue Jays sort of look at the situation, identify, okay, what are our immediate needs? What are our longer term needs? How does this player fit into the short and the long term? And what are we getting back and what's that doing for us in the moment?
Yeah. And it's always interesting to look at which potential trade partners value. We want the 1A top prospect versus, you know, they've made a bunch of deals with the Athletics over the years where they value volume and a couple kicks at the can. Or, you know, there are teams like the smaller market teams that value guys who will be quick to the majors because they just need someone. They need guys to fill roster spots. And those ones strike me as the one the Blue Jays are really good trade candidates with because they have a lot of kind of AAA guys ready to go or bench guys who could get a longer look. Shai, thanks so much for doing this, man. Also, really great job on the Father's Day piece on the Budzinski family and Mark Budzinski yesterday. Really appreciated that one and appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Oh, thanks, guys. My thanks to the Budzinski family for being willing to share. It was a privilege to have the trust to tell that story. So not your typical Father's Day piece, but I think an important and important one with a lot of good messages in it.
Yeah, you did a great job on it, you and Stephen Payne and everyone else on that. So thanks again, Shai.
Take care, guys.
Shai Davidi, Sportsnet Baseball Insider. Make sure you check out all his great work at Sportsnet.ca, which if you are listening to a Blue Jays radio and television show, you are obviously reading all Shai and Ben and David's work and everyone else. One other minor league thing.
Yep.
So we normally don't get to see FCL games. We don't get to see the Complex League games. But some teams put theirs for free on YouTube. So I got to check out a little bit of Johnny King's game yesterday. It was low def enough that I wasn't 1,000% sure it was Johnny King. I had to check the box score. Like Johnny King like kind of looks like he has a Jamie Campbell-ish look to him.
Right, okay, really.
And it looked like he cut his big red hair a little bit. So I was like, is this Johnny? And then it was. So it was not a good enough feed to like really tell much from it. But cool, because normally we don't get to see those at all.
Right.
So cool to see a couple innings. And yeah, you talk about a guy who needs a level bump. He is ready to move from the Complex League to single A. I think for anyone who doesn't know, Johnny King was their third round pick last year, and he was out of high school. So he's still quite young. He's not even 19 yet, but in 19 and a third innings in the Complex League so far, a 1.40 ERA and over 15 strikeouts per nine. So
yeah, I think it's time.
He might be ready for a test. He's also not walking anyone, and every piece of contact he gives up is on the ground.
Right.
So like his whiff rate is almost 50%. Again, only 19 innings, so like grains of salt. But when guys are swinging and missing 50% of the time, and then 2/3 of the time when they do make contact, it's on the ground.
Yeah, it probably means that you're way better than the competition. And to Shai's point, stay here any longer, you might start wasting your time a little bit.
Yeah,
we'll see how the Blue Jays.
I'm sure with an 18-year-old pitcher, they'll be careful, yeah, but sure. I would like to see that get the Dunedin bump at some point. I'm not in charge, so we'll see.
That's good news, though. Listen, how did you find that game? How did you even know
how
to look for it?
My friend Eric, who works here and is a big Jays fan, just alerted me that it was available on YouTube.
Wow. So, and you're like, I'm not doing anything anyway. So,
well, it was like, I was like at the gym and I was like, I could turn this on while I'm on the treadmill and watch 20 minutes or something like that. I think I caught two innings of it. So, yeah, this is it. Have sicko friends who know when an FCL game is getting put on YouTube. All right.
All right.
Let's take a break. Second hour, we're going to talk to Anthony Kastrovitz. He's down at the MLB Draft Combine. We will not give him a hard time about Canadian exchange rates. we're going to treat it like the Buffalo Bisons and everything's at par. But we'll talk to him about the MLB Draft Combine, Shohei's return. We'll talk to Steve Berthiaume later in the show as well. He's the Diamondbacks play-by-play voice. We'll get set up for that series. Right now, we're going to take a break. On the other side, we're going to talk to Dan Zimborski. We'll talk Shohei's debut. We'll talk about the projection impact of the Rafael Devers trade. Craig Breslow said yesterday that he thinks they're going to win more games than they would have otherwise, which is really, really odd considering zero pieces they got back for their best hitter are on the major league roster today. So we'll see how that shakes
we'll
out
see what Dan
in the
has
numbers.
To say for sure.
Yeah, we'll just kick it around. All right. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. The Toronto Blue Jays get back in action tonight. Also, tonight in baseball, a Spencer Strider and his dog Kipnis on a bobblehead together giveaway. However, the legs just look like normal people legs.
What?
Spencer Strider's legs just look like normal, like baggy pants. Sorry. Like, I don't expect a bobblehead to like carve the quad meat or anything like that, but it looks like Spencer Strider and Kipnis from the dog upward, but it's
waist down.
You can't tell that's
I will say this. No. It's okay. I just...
Yesterday was leg day.
I'm going to get Amit to work on a montage of your obsession with Spencer Strider's legs.
I don't know.
It's been a recurring theme, and I love it.
Well, it's a big part of his pitching power. Also pitching this week. Last night, Shohei Ohtani made his return. Let's talk to Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs about it. Dan, good morning, man. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Glad to get with you guys today.
Yeah, sorry to hear what kept you from the show yesterday, which we don't need to get into. But, man, I hope at least you were able to get all that sorted in time to check out Shohei Ohtani's one inning last night. Did you get a chance to watch it?
Yes, I did. But who's not going to watch an Ohtani inning after, you know, a year and a half, is it now? It was an interesting appearance. It was a guy who was obviously, he looked a lot like someone who hadn't pitched much in a while. There was some spots, but his stuff was also there. He didn't come back like Noah Syndergaard throwing 91 or anything. He still came back throwing pretty hard. So you can see the picture there. He's just not there yet.
Yeah, I think it's the way I kind of described it is as far as rehab outings go, Dan, it was a pretty good one.
Yeah, he came back a little different too. He almost looked like he was trying to pitch like Blake Treinen does, because he came back with the sinker, and maybe I've lost my mind, but I don't remember that sinker before. But who knows?
Yeah, listen, either way, and as Blake sort of takes a look here, I saw you furiously typing as
you're not
as
supposed
Dan
to give that away
that.
To the audience when I'm doing research for the show.
Oh, sorry. I'm still getting the hang of it. It's my first year on this job, but Dan, I don't think that anyone expects Shohei Ohtani to, you know, build up to a full starter's load right away. That's just not how it works, especially out of Tommy John. The fact that he can't go out on a rehab assignment, the fact that he's still hitting and, you know, 2-for-4 with 2 RBIs or whatever it was yesterday. But how do you see his usage? If this is what the Dodgers keep doing here, how do you see his usage as an opener, considering how much this team needs innings right now?
I know they do need innings right now, but they're understandably going to be cautious, I think, with him because he's so important to the team. Because if he has a serious injury, you don't only lose the pitcher that's who's throwing a few innings, you might lose the hitter too. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big deal, obviously, when you're talking about Ohtani. I do expect him to just slowly, slowly ramp him up. The thing about the Dodgers is one of the big things they did this offseason is they made a lot of pitching additions, but a lot of it was adding depth so that when they had their usual problem of having 12 starters on the disabled, on the injured list or something, that they'd be a little insured against that kind of thing. And that's had mixed results this year. But I think we'll start seeing Ohtani throw 1, 2, 3 innings. I don't think he's probably ever going to have anywhere near traditional starter workload, even by 2025 standards. But what he can give them is pretty important.
Yeah, absolutely. And if he can be the 3.14 ERA that he had before he was injured in his last season with the Angels, but Zips rest of season has him for 3.82. Even that at the start of games would be very, very welcome with the Dodgers. So Shohei, the pitching side is obviously a interesting and difficult one to project. Something that's maybe a little easier to run through the Zips projection system, Dan, have you had a chance yet to sit with the Rafael Devers trade and kind of work through how this changes both the AL East and the NL West in terms of rest of this season?
Well, when you talk about it in the short term, it's a really big deal for the Giants. They've had problems at first base. They have Eldridge in the minors, but they have an understandable – they don't want to rush him too quickly. And there is a spot on the team for him, even with Devers on the team. For the Red Sox, the company line about we might win more games this year, that's kind of hard to believe. I understand on some part – it was awkward having him in the mix because you can't really use your entire roster when you're sticking him at DH because you have other players on that roster that need to be at DH. And when you have Devers, you do not have your entire lineup. But I don't think it's so much that they would actually be better without him.
Yeah, and listen, you look at the contract, right? And that is one thing that, you know, the Red Sox are kind of going to try to hammer home. It's the financial flexibility and all of that. And you can take
the deal you just gave them. Sure.
You can do with that what you will. But when it comes to, I guess, you know, the production that a guy like Devers can give you on the field, especially at Oracle rather than at Fenway, maybe we'll see a bit of a difference in power numbers there. But he is owed a lot of money, right? How do you, I guess, balance those two things, Dan, for a team like the Giants acquiring a player like Devers?
I think the good thing with Devers is that his contract isn't obviously underwater. Like, you sometimes see contracts of that size. He would probably get about what he's getting now on in free agency, even possibly a little more. Not as much as say, Guerrero, simply because he's a couple years older than Guerrero. But he's a valuable player, and the Giants are happy to pay him to do that. They remember they wanted to sign Aaron Judge, and they were close, and it was even reported as that they were close at one point. But the Giants kind of missed out on a lot of free agents, kind of like the Blue Jays did, but I won't push that particular wound. For the Red Sox, I think they were happy with the contract, but if he was a problem for the team and another team wanted to pick him up, they don't mind having that flexibility back. So in that sense, it made it easier to move him because of the deal. But I don't think the deal was necessarily a big problem. Obviously, I don't think the Red Sox could necessarily do much with that money until we get to the end of the season, because there are only so many guys you can actually pick up at the trade deadline, especially with big contracts. And the ones who do move tend to not be worth their big contracts. So I think the Red Sox are going to be a bit worse. It doesn't doom the team. But, it's a serious hit to their offense.
Yeah, and it opens up the AL East is already very tight. I mentioned earlier the three AL East teams would hold the three wild card spots if things ended today. And it's much, it's a little too early at least to look at playoff odds and things like that. But you have to like if you are a Blue Jays fan or a Rays fan or even a Yankees fan as they cool off a little bit. And I know the Red Sox have won 6 in a row, but you take Devers out of that race and that's notable. Dan, curious as to your read on the Jays from afar, because you've been coming on the show for a couple years now, and a couple of those years were well, the offense is underperforming and is it going to come around? And we've looked at individual guys, and the Jays actually, I think this is one of the first times you've come on and things actually record wise look pretty good for the Jays and aren't that bad. So what is your, we can talk specifics too with Vlad and Bo and guys like that. But where the Jays are sitting here kind of at the 40% mark, how are you feeling about this year's Toronto Blue Jays?
Well, I do like that they're actually closer to my projection this year, because I had them at, I think, 90 last year, which did not happen, almost happened the opposite way. But they're in a pretty good place right now. There are some concerns, but when you look at the players who are concerns, you see a legitimate path for them to hit better. I think a good example of that is Guerrero, who isn't having the season he had last year, but he hasn't been terrible, and you can still see him improving from where he is. Right now. He's still getting on base, but hasn't hit with the power that he has in recent years. Of course, the big question this year is, because I thought the Anthony Santander signing was a good signing, and it has not worked out that way so far. So there are some concerns, but I think they're in a decent place. I think the Blue Jays, if they want to be active at the trade deadline, they're one of those teams that would get a pretty big benefit, especially if you could shore up. Get another arm in the rotation. There are definite places to improve, but it's not bad.
So Guerrero's a straightforward one, and we've kicked around on the show that it's a little hard to diagnose when he goes into one of these lulls where the power's not there, because we see it like once every year, it seems like, and he's still 26, and his Zips rest of season projection still has him for an OPS north of 850 the rest of the way. Bo Bichette, kind of a lesser version of that, but still, model confidence that they're going to be better the rest of the way. But Santander is interesting because, well, one, he's 30. He just got this long-term contract. And Dan, I remember a couple weeks ago, you wrote about players who have changed their 2026 projections noticeably already. And look, we're focused on 2025 for the most part for the Blue Jays. But what does that tell you when a guy is 30 and he gets off to such a cold start that now we're not even thinking he's struggling right now, but you start to see long-term changes in your projections? What do you make of that with Santander and just in general when that happens to guys?
Well, the good thing is that when you talk about a 30-year-old player instead of a 32-year-old or a 34-year-old player, we do have a higher chance of having that bounce back season. It's painful now, but it should be at least better than this. Generally, the cliff doesn't beckon this soon. There are some they're concerning parts of his profile. His contact's down from last year. He's never been the great best plate discipline guy, but there's still room for improvement there. I think that he needs to make some adjustments in that light. I don't know how to fix him, but I think it's likely he'll be at least somewhat of the player they hope to sign.
And that's good news. I think that the Blue Jays will take that at this point, because it has not been.
Yeah, notable that a couple of those weeks came while he was playing hurt, and he's now underwent a PRP injection and isn't even swinging yet and stuff. I'm sure that's a part of it. It doesn't explain the first couple weeks, but it maybe explains the last couple weeks of it.
Yeah, the first couple of weeks, I would argue that there's at least a little bit of this is a completely new team, a new environment. You're getting used to
your surroundings. And he always starts slow.
That's a good point. A guy who doesn't ever starts low. I know he's in a mini slump right now, Dan, but Aaron Judge.
Three games of mini slump.
Well, one for 11. Nice. It's a pretty considerable one for a guy like Aaron Judge, especially as the offense also struggles, right, behind him. It's not just him at this point. But you took a look, Dan, at Aaron Judge's push for a triple crown this season. And it seems like there's still a good chance that it happens. I know that you wrote that in late May. But what are you making of this Aaron Judge season? It does seem like he keeps one-upping himself.
Yeah, I like when we talk about a slump. It's like, he didn't hit a home run tonight. He's really struggling.
He's cooked.
The thing is that you look at him this year, and even with a mini slump, he's still hitting .377, and we are more than halfway through June now. It's hard, for a baseball player to carry an offense, say, the way that prime Michael Jordan could carry an offense. But Judge is as close to it as we've seen right now. He's really just become just this remorseless, brutal hitting machine that terrorizes pitchers. I think that he's I think he still really has a great shot at a Triple Crown race. I talked about it a few weeks ago in an article that some of the his competition, like Ohtani, has left the American League, which makes it even more wide open. But when you're talking about, you'd be disappointed if he only finished with 50 home runs, you know you're talking about a pretty crazy hitter.
Well, you talk about competition going to the NL. You know who is second in the American League in runs batted in? Rafael Devers. So now his top competition for the RBI race is out. And he must hate catchers because his top competition for the home run race, he's tied with Cal Raleigh with 26 home runs. And his top competition in the batting average race, and I'm lowering the qualification standard here, but Tyler Heineman's the only guy with a higher batting average than Aaron Judge right now. Only 66 plate appearances, but he's got to catch up to Heineman's 410 here. Dan, another name I wanted to ask you about that you wrote about, and it was a really great piece going into the specifics of what has made Luis Arraez Luis Arraez. And he's a fascinating player. He's more interesting than he is good, even though he's won a bunch of batting titles. There's not a lot of power, not a lot of base running, not a lot of defense. But you dove in, and what you're seeing is even some of the contact stuff, which is, you know, synonymous with Luis Arraez's success, is maybe even becoming a little bit of a hindrance for him this season as his average drops to 274 now for the Padres. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing underneath the hood with Arraez?
One of the things about Arraez is he can hit anything, basically hit. He's got this absurd contact rate against pitches hit outside the strike zone. That's just dwarfs the major league average. And there's a problem with that because if you can hit everything, you're hitting nothing because then one ball is as good as another. And we know that's not true, even for a hitter like Arraez. There are certain pitches that he is going to be able to hit better than others. And just because you can hit that pitch that's 2 feet off the plate somehow doesn't mean you necessarily should. And as you look at him in recent years, he's become more and more aggressive with the plate. He's hitting more and more pitches, but the problem comes that he's hitting more and more pitches poorly. He's never going to be a guy who does launch angle and hits 30 home runs a year, but he does need to have those hits. He can hit a lot of line drives off of. That's been a big part of his superpower, so to speak. So he does need to kind of tone down it a little bit. Don't just try to make contact, try to make good contact. And that's what's hurt his batting average this year, because he's hitting just so many bad pitches and they're just becoming weak outs. So he's never going to be, you know, a superstar, but he's a fun hitter because he's a type we don't see as much as we used to.
Yeah.
And very reminiscent of Ernie Clement in the conversations we have around him. Obviously, yeah, they are different hitters for
sure.
Yeah,
Ernie's got a little bit more pop in there.
Yeah, but we have heard manager John Schneider say something very similar about him. It can be a curse to be able to get to every ball.
Well, even the Jays as a team, you know, we got asked in the mailbag the other day what we're seeing under the hood and the offense cooling off on this road trip a little bit. It was, well, the chase rate's way up, the swing and miss rate isn't up. So what does that mean? Well, you're swinging at more stuff outside of the zone and you're still making contact with it, but you're probably not going to do as much damage on something that's, you know, a ball and a half width outside the zone just because you can make contact with it. So it's a great point, Dan, and it's part of what makes Arraez so fascinating and really interesting to not just project projection wise, but like try to figure out how long he'll stick around and how much he can kind of turn that part around. Dan, before we let you go here, I also have to say happy early birthday. I know we're a day or two early here, but hope you have a great one, man.
Thanks. I'm turning 47, so that's not an exciting birthday. You don't get anything for being 47 like you get for like being 18. You can vote, 21, you can drink legally, 25, you can rent a car. Nothing happens at 47.
47, you just get to come on Jays Talk Plus. It's really not that exciting.
Yeah, what is it?
Thanks, guys. You have a good one.
47, I will say, you're at the last one where no Major League Baseball player has ever played older than you. Julio Franco played till 48. Once you're 48, it's like, okay, no one could play baseball at my age anymore. That's all I got for you at 47, man.
Julio Franco, I swear, I think he was about 70 when he retired. he was born in the 1930s. Yeah. He always had that old face.
Yeah, fascinating one. Dan, thanks so much, man, and happy birthday.
Thanks, guys.
Dan Zimborski of Fangraphs, creator of Zips. So if you're looking at the projection systems over at Fangraphs, a little early in the year for playoff odds and things like that. But anytime you go on a player page and you see the rest of season projections, which are helpful because we get emotional and ride the ups and downs. And, you know, the model isn't always correct because it can't tell approach changes and things like that as quickly in real time as Addison Barger opened up his stance and changed his foot positioning. However, when it comes to an established name like a Vladimir Guerrero Jr. or Bo Bichette, where we have to ride the ups and downs a little bit in an everyday, it can be helpful to just take a step back and take a look. The other thing I will say, the reason that we don't always tell the guests that I'm looking something up is in case they're incorrect, I would never jump in and be like, you're wrong. Shohei Ohtani did throw a
sticker
before, but that's why we don't reveal until we're ready.
Well, listen, if people are watching on television, they will see it.
Yeah, there's but they don't know. I'm checking my email.
Okay, next time I'll say, sorry guys, Blake's checking his email.
You just don't have to say anything about it. I managed to do all this stuff without a co-host to talk in those spots for 3 years. So
I'm a reporter. This is what I do.
I'm not your subject. No one wants Jay's Talk Plus talking about Jay's Talk Plus. So in that spirit, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go down to the MLB Draft Combine. Anthony Castrovince is set to interview the sons of Manny Ramirez and CeCe Sabathia at the MLB Draft Combine this week. We'll hear all about it. We'll go around baseball as well. Steve Berthiaume will join us as well to set up Jays Diamondbacks, which gets going at 7:07 tonight. Chris Bassett against Brandon Pfaadt. All that's next in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Now we're going to go down to the MLB Draft Combine. We are joined by ofmlb.com and author of A Fan's Guide to Baseball Analytics, a very, very helpful book in terms of getting you up to speed on everything we're talking about on shows like this and on modern baseball broadcasts. It's Anthony Castrovince. Anthony, how are you, man? Thanks for doing this.
I'm well. You brought me en route to the combine, so if you get some atmospheric noise, you'll know this is what it's like to travel to the MLB Draft Combine. It's every kid's dream.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not because it didn't exist all that long ago, but it is like, if you had told younger Anthony Castrovince, you are going to talk to Manny Ramirez's son, CeCe Sabathia's son, that would be pretty cool. I know that makes us all feel pretty old, I think. But man, how much are you looking forward to that aspect of it? Kind of these second generation waves of guys that you're going to get to interact with this week.
Yeah. There's been a lot of those for me in recent years, but the CC one really cuts particularly deep because that was I was young on the Indians beat back in the day when he was, you know, finding it and becoming the ace he grew to be, the Cy Young winner he grew to be. And of course I saw his son Carsten quite a bit back in those days. So yeah, it's happening to me. It happens to all of us. If you hang around long enough, you'll see some stuff.
Does it give you, Anthony, I guess, a chance to zoom out on your career a little bit and see how far you've come, how many eras of pro baseball you have gotten to cover here?
Yeah, or maybe just not how far I've come, right? Because I'm still covering a Sabathia all these years.
Good point.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So I mentioned the combine's fairly new-ish. It's been rolling for a couple years now. Have you gone before?
Yeah, I've gone the last few years. It's a cool event. You know, you get to know these guys on a deeper level just prior to the draft. And I mean, just as a reporter, it gives you, like, because I'm not firmly focused like some of our crew here on the pipeline, on the draft prospects. So for me, it's a great opportunity to learn more about these guys before they infiltrate the professional ranks. And then, you know, you get more of a rooting interest just on a personal level. You know, you get their backstories and, but you know, it's not just about interacting with goobers like me. Obviously, for them, it's tactical, where they take batting practice and all that, and that's what they show on air. But I think actually the more relevant aspect of the combine comes after the cameras are put away and when they go through their physicals. And that way, all the teams have objective information about these guys And I believe there's an element where they're guaranteed a, you know, certain signing bonus should they sign, you know, if they participate in that. So, so it's good for both. It's good for all parties, basically, to have clear, objective data, which, as we know, in today's game is everything, you know, for the top prospects in the draft.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear when guys come out of it. There was a Canadian catching prospect, Nathan Flewelling, last year, who was like a big riser because of some of the data they collected at the combine, big exit velos and stuff like that. You are a pretty data-forward analyst. What is your understanding of, like the college information we have available is way better than it was 5 or 10 years ago or anything like that. But the ability to get them in a controlled environment like this where it's their measurement tools, it's their drills, and things like that. How valuable do teams find that aspect of it in your experience?
Well, incredibly valuable. And all the teams are represented here. And again, they'll all have information to access and assess after the fact. And we're still, you know, I got 1 foot in each direction. I still got 1 foot in the past where I still see it all the time. You see stories of guys who fall in the draft for one reason or another, but had some scout who believed in them. And I still value that stuff. And I think the good teams still value both aspects of that, you know? And I know that always sounds like a cop-out, but you need a little bit of both, but you really do. Scouting still matters in the sport.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like a cop-out to me. And like, you look at all the guys who are successful, like, yeah, occasionally there's a Paul Skeens who's just so undeniable, but a lot of the guys who end up making it, you hear these stories of like, oh, there was this thing that a team believed in, or this thing had to click right. Especially like more than any other sport, the MLB draft is imperfect in terms of finding guys in later rounds and things like that. The attrition rate of first round picks. So I think that stuff's really important. And I'd imagine, Anthony, too, there's a pretty valuable element with this week where teams get to talk to, like, obviously players are going through and talking to people like you and analysts and things like that, but they're also talking to teams. And I'd imagine the interview part of this is probably a big component of the team's legwork as well.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny, you see some guys walk around in khakis and polos, you know, like a real like a job interview in a tech company or whatever. But no, it matters because personality matters too. Look, we just had one of the top 10 hitters in MLB get traded by the Red Sox because of a conflict, basically, in the clubhouse, in their dynamic and how they operate. And so the more you get to know a player, what makes him tick, what kind of teammate is he, you know, all those aspects, the better, you know, the more information you have, the better. So personality still matters in the sport as well. Cause that, you're in the grind with people for 162 games. You better have good people in that room. You better have people that work well together.
Yeah, Anthony, listen, you gave us such a perfect segue to talk about Rafael Devers here. Because, listen, we've all been sort of, you know, following along as the drama unfolded with the Red Sox. But I don't think many of us expected this level of, you know, just implosion, really, because it was a big deal. And it's still a big deal. And people are talking about it. And you hear Craig Breslow yesterday. Just from your point of view as a national reporter, one, how shocked were you? And two, now that we've all had a chance to let the dust settle, where are you at with this trade?
I was shocked. I was not shocked that he was traded. I was shocked when he was traded. You would think that this would be something that would, because obviously things were not good there. You know, when he refused to play first base, and then even more pointedly, when Alex Bregman gets hurt and he doesn't go back to third base, like that tells you everything you need to know. Like, this is something's wrong here. I think it's a myth. But I thought it would be a situation where they shop him in the winter, you know, and try to find the best value there and maybe a wider pool of teams. Who knows? And their own situation would have been more clear then, too, in terms of Alex Bregman and his opt out. You know, it just, you'd have more information fundamentally. And they're just starting to get hot. So it was just very strange timing. You know, at worst, you thought maybe the trade deadline if they fall out of it, but they're not out of it. They just got back in it, and then they trade their best hitter. So it's very puzzling on that aspect. I get getting out from the money, totally get it. But as you guys know, in Toronto with the Vladimir Guerrero Jr. contract, I mean, that's not an ideal contract for a franchise, you know, long term. But that's something that's the cost of doing business right now, you know. So Rafi Devers for another $250 million. I mean, that's the cost of doing business. I know it's suboptimal because he's gravitating more towards DH role, but you know, it's just that's the cost of doing business. So they did not get much in return, clearly, but they got up from that money. We'll see what they do with it long term. But it's hard to say, like Craig Breslow saying yesterday that they, you know, he thinks there's a window to maybe be a better team the rest of the way this season. I don't see that, but who knows? Stranger things have happened, I guess.
Yeah, they don't hand out playoff spots based on dollars per wins above replacement. they just don't do it that way. So sorry, Breza. Okay, so the other thing here is I absolutely feel for Red Sox fans. This sucks. The Mookie thing sucked. However, and I was very glad to see you push back on Jared Karrabis when he said on Twitter, no team makes it harder to root for them than the Boston Red Sox. Now, you are a Cleveland Browns fan. I am a Jacksonville Jaguars fan, which they're not even relevant enough to get in that conversation. But Boston sports have won 13 titles and made 20 finals over the last 25 years. I just wanted to say thank you for telling a Red Sox fan to cool it on how hard it is to be a Boston sports fan. This sucks. Boston sports fandom has had a fine 20, 25 years.
That's right. And just to correct the record, I am from Cleveland, but I am not a Cleveland Browns fan.
Oh, my bad.
I have a healthy amount of low self-esteem, but I would not do that to myself. I don't hate myself that much. But being in Cleveland, I mean, I see it like, I don't know, man. I don't know how it could be much worse than that with what they've done to the, which is actually a really strong, supportive fan base and just get dragged through the mud winner after winner. But yeah, Jared, Jared does great work, but yes. No, that was a bit much. That was a bit too emotional in the moment there. I had to temper that down a little bit.
Wait, so how, obviously the self-esteem and component is great. We're all for self-care. Good for you for not being a Browns fan. So are you just not a football guy, or you just somehow managed to avoid getting sucked into the Browns aspect of it too?
I was a football guy as a kid, and I don't know. This is how old I am. I had a game called VCR football. And your play, you draw a card, and then your play was the next play on the tape. And the tape was always these great Steelers highlights from the 70s. And so I kind of fell in love with the Steelers, which is awkward in Cleveland. Now I just don't care. I know. And
yeah.
They can bash each other's heads in, and I'm out of it. But I still now my team is watching the Browns lose, you know, in inventive, sometimes hilarious fashion. Like, that is my entertainment.
That's very amusing. Okay, back to one last one, back to Devers for you. Mike Petriello just wrote about this for MLB.com today about the change in park. And if we just look at the Statcast, would this be a homer in this park? It's not a huge difference between his Fenway results and his Oracle results so far. However, San Fran is a really difficult park to put up big numbers in. Nobody has hit 30 home runs for the Giants since Barry Bonds. How fascinated are you by that aspect, and what do you expect in terms of how, if you've gotten a chance to look at it much yet, how Devers projects in San Fran?
Yeah, I mean, one thought I had while kind of thinking about this trade, and again, that internal dynamic where there was obviously discord, is there had to be some element to Craig Breslow or whoever in the Red Sox front office, like, all right, man, you don't want to change positions for us. Hey, go play at Oracle Park. Good luck to you. Because that's real. You know, that's real. That's going to have a real impact on him. He's a great hitter. Don't get me wrong. And he can overcome that. But there's a reason why that stat you just mentioned, which is one of the crazier stats in baseball about, you know, no 30 home run hitters for the Giants since Barry Bonds. I mean, that exists for a reason. There's a reason why they've had trouble reeling in free agents of the ilk of, you know, an Aaron Judge, for instance. It's very real. So I don't know. You want to be careful with that, because I remember saying this stuff about Nelson. The big one is Nelson Cruz when he signed with the Mariners, and we all thought, what a terrible deal. Oh, my God. And he was great. So, you know, great hitters can overcome extreme elements, but that is going to be a big change for him, no doubt.
Anthony, when you sort of look at this trade from the Giants' side, and we even had Clayton Kershaw, I forget if it was yesterday or a couple of days ago, sort of joining the broadcast and saying, yeah, man, Buster is doing it. Buster Posey is he's on it. Yeah. What does that tell you about a guy who hasn't, you know, he retired a few years ago, relatively recently here, comes in, takes over as president of baseball ops, pulls off this trade? What have you made of Buster Posey's tenure so far?
Well, it's a fascinating trade, because you think about it, and it's Buster Posey and Craig Breslow. There's two former players, and they are going about it completely different ways. And you're seeing, you know, critique of Breslow being kind of robotic and obviously very analytical. I covered him briefly as a player with the Indians. He was very analytical then. That was 20 years ago. And now he's doing it that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we've seen in this game, you can have great success with a deeply analytical mindset. But what I like having some variety, you know, because it has become very uniform in terms of player evaluations and everybody kind of drawing from the same mindset, the same data, et cetera. So it's fun that to have not just a former player, but a future Hall of Famer, a great former player coming in and saying, you know, we're going to value things like just, are you a winner? Or, you know, these things that are easy to roll your eyes at, and yet you also miss them at the same time, you know? So, but yeah, acquire really good players. There's a good strategy, and, you know, it's working well for them so far. Willy Adames has not worked out so well, but maybe this will elevate him as well in that lineup. We'll see, but no, I'm all for having, you know, variety of mindsets and different ways of going about it. And I have great respect for Buster Posey.
Yeah, I'm all for the variety mindset if it gets Rafael Devers out of the American League East for the rest of this season, too, when there's such a tight wild card race. And sends him to the NL West, where that division is obviously fascinating. And it got more fascinating last night, Anthony. We were all watching, of course, Shohei Ohtani's return as a pitcher. I know you were posted about it a little bit. Like, it's hard to put in context exactly what he's doing, and to do it with no rehab assignment or anything like that. Man, I know we have run the gamut, I thought, of ways to be amazed at Shohei Ohtani. Are we finding new ones here with him coming back with no rehab right into major league games and throwing 98, touching 98 on his first pitch and then touching 100 a little later? Just incredible stuff, man.
Yeah, fascinating way to go about it. And maybe there was no other way to go about it, because it's not like you want to pull him out of your lineup for, you know, a couple weeks or whatever. So they went into the season thinking they had the pitching depth to navigate this on whatever timetable they wanted. And they did slow play it. But I think ultimately what's gone on with their, you know, ravaged by injuries yet again in their rotation, they did push it up a little more than they thought. I don't think the plan was to see him until after the All-Star break on the mound. So, and he also forced the issue as well, you know, where this was supposed to be his next side session on the mound. Instead, his side session became an inning against the Padres. So, he's got control's not quite there yet, but, the workload is not there yet. He's just going to get stretched back out and before he can really impact their rotation in a meaningful way. But I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but like, it had been a while, and it's like, we know this. I'm always telling myself, don't take this for granted, that if I could do this, especially, you know, not to pull rank or anything, but like, I've talked to so many pitchers in the last 20 years about what goes into preparing for a start. It's just, it's still mind-blowing to think that in those days in between, he's, you know, hitting 100-mile-per-hour home runs. You know, that's just so absurd. The whole thing's just nuts. And it was just nuts to see him back out there again. Like, that's their DH on the mound. What's he doing out there, you know? So it's still absolutely crazy to me and so fun.
It is. And listen, when you talk about Ohtani forcing the issue as well a little bit, I know it's hard to, especially from afar, to sort of analyze that. But how much of this do you think that it's player driven as well, in understanding where the team is when it comes to their pitching depth, how much they need him, and saying, yeah, Listen, I'm ready, let's go.
Yeah, it's huge. And we haven't seen it yet. We haven't seen Shohei Ohtani do the two-way thing in the playoffs. So what does that look like? I don't know. It's going to be fascinating, but we're getting there. You know, I think the Dodgers are going to be in the playoffs. Whether they'll utilize him in a two-way role remains to be seen, but there's a guy who, to him, this is all just, hey, this is what I do. You know, he probably feels more whole again. But I mean, what an absurd player. I mean, he's the greatest player in baseball history. I'm sorry. I'm not saying he's going to have the greatest career in baseball history when all is said and done. You know, you can argue about your Willie Mayses and your Babe Ruth, Hank Aaron, et cetera, but this is the greatest baseball player in history. There's nobody like him. It's just unfathomable. So, you know, to go out and, hey, I'm not pitching this year, so I'm going to have a 50-50 season. It's just completely crazy. So, but yeah, the playoff thing is the big X factor here for me. I'll be very, you know, we'll talk more about it when we get there, I guess, but you know, what's this leading to in terms of his role in the playoffs?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the idea of starter, opener, whatever, come in as I know it would be really hard to warm up in game while you're also hitting, but hey, I wasn't planned, but we need an extra pitcher. I'll come in and pitch, you know, kind of Bumgarner in game 7 kind of stuff. It'll be, it'll be really fascinating to see. Anthony, know you got to get to the combine. There's MLB network coverage all day from noon onward, and of course your stuff at MLB.com. Really appreciate you taking out the time this morning. Also really appreciated the Denzel Clark video essay and breakdown, because he is from very close to here, and it's been a blast to watch him. So thank you for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Something in the water up there in Toronto. You guys got mad hops up there.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks,
Anthony,
for having me, guys.
Thanks so much, man. Anthony Kastrovitz, MLB and MLB.com. Again, draft combine coverage from noon onward on MLB Network. Full slate of games tonight, but they don't get underway until 6:30. So if you are the type of person who enjoys the draft, if you're the type of person who does not get to keep up on all the draft prospects and wants to kind of catch up, that's a good way to do it. Anthony also had some great stuff coming out of the AUSL opening weekend. Cool stuff. Here's a little trivia for you.
Tell me.
So since Barry Bonds hit 45 home runs as a Giant in 2004, so Bonds stuck around for three more years after that, but he didn't crack 30 home runs. So
okay.
2004, so you're talking about 20 seasons. No Giant has hit 30 home runs.
Okay.
Do you know which Giant has the most home runs in a single season since then? And I will give you a big hint of there is a Blue Jays tie-in.
There is a Blue Jays tie-in? It's not. It couldn't be. It could not be. It's not Matt Chapman.
No.
Okay.
No. No, although he did hit 27 last year.
Yeah.
So that's there are two players who have hit more than that. Barry Bonds had 28 one of those years, and then someone had 29.
Someone had 29.
In 2021.
In 2021.
And then shortly after that became a Blue Jay.
What? Just tell me.
Brandon Belt.
What? No way.
Brandon Belt has the most home runs in a season for the Giants since Barry Bonds in 2004. He had 29, and he did it in only 97 games.
Wow.
If he had been a little healthier that year, he would have the 30, and we wouldn't have this wonderful stat. But Brandon Belt, 29. Barry Bonds, 28. Hunter Pence and Matt Chapman with 27 each.
Right on. Listen, it's also a little bit, at this point, easy to forget that Brandon Belt played for the Blue Jays. No disrespect. He actually had a great season.
He did.
In Toronto.
I remain surprised that he didn't get a job after that. Like, he had a weighted runs created plus of almost 140 that season. Like, he was a well above average hitter.
It was pretty impressive. And I think that was his last season, right?
Yeah, he hasn't signed since.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows if it was really a lack of offers, if it was just
It seems like it. He did J.D. Bunkus' show last season at some point, and it seemed like, he would have.
He was ready to continue.
Yeah.
That's very interesting because, he had a good season. You can always count on him to hit some home runs, it seems like. And he kind of carried the Blue Jays a little bit at times during that year as they made their way to the wild card series. That was 23, was it?
Yeah, 22 and 20. Well, 23 he was on the team. 22, he was still with the Giants.
Wow, that is pretty fascinating.
Yeah,
I shouldn't forget because it was such a good season and he was such a presence in that clubhouse as well. But there you go. That was fun. I like it when you have a little bit of trivia. I'll never know the answer, but it's cool. I feel like I'm learning new things every day.
Buster Posey, by the way, had 24 one season.
That I was going to bring up.
That one would have been a really nice tie-in. Like, he's like, no one's hit home runs like I've hit with the Giants since Barry Bonds. Let's get someone in here. He's a fascinating one too. You want to highlight how difficult that park is to hit for power in. He had the exact same weighted runs created plus at home and away for his career. So he played his entire career with the Giants. His OBP and batting average were almost identical. 300 at home, 303 away. OBP 371 at home, 372 away. That's how close all these numbers were. And his weighted runs created plus, which takes into account ballpark factors and things like that, were identical. 61 home runs at home, 97 away.
It's a tough park to hit. It's just tough. I mean, what do you do? But if anyone is going to change that a little bit and change the narrative, it is going to be Rafael.
Posey's such a fascinating, like, the numbers could not be more similar across the board, home and away.
And then
he hit 50% more home runs on the road.
Yeah. Oracle Park. That's it's nice when it lands in the ocean, but
doesn't happen all that often.
It'll be cool. I mean, the Giants didn't play yesterday. They're back in action tonight. I don't expect us to have a lineup yet. I'm not too sure, but this will be definitely an interesting week to sort of see how things go for Rafael Devers. And
they're actually
not
in Cleveland. We could have drove it all home Anthony were he not in Arizona for the
to run out of time.
But the combine.
But let's not forget that the Red Sox are in San Francisco this weekend.
Yes.
So if you get tired of Blue Jays White Sox, or if the game ends early and you can catch that, that will definitely have
and
some
sorry,
drama.
I misspoke. The Guardians are in San Francisco, not the Giants in Cleveland.
Okay.
So yes, Cleveland. The Giants are about to start a 9-game homestand against Cleveland, Boston, and Miami. So big drama against Boston, and then good eating against Miami. So Devers could get off to a nice little start here, win himself some fans. The Jays are back in action tonight against the Arizona Diamondbacks. We will see Chris Bassitt against Brandon Pfaadt tonight at 7:00, tomorrow at 7:00. TBD, Eric Lauer and Spencer Turnbull figure to be a part of it against Eduardo Rodriguez, who has been much better in his two starts back since from the IL. I don't know if that means he was pitching through something or it was just your arm's a little dead, go on the IL, but he's been very good his last two times out. And then Thursday, on a work-from-dome day, we'll get Kevin Gausman against Ryan Nelson. The Gate 14 guy's thrown out the first pitch at that one, which should be a lot of fun.
Good for them.
And Amit, our producer, get ready to get that video if it's a bad one. We will break that down for sure. So to get set for this Diamondback series, we're going to take a break. We'll talk to the play-by-play voice of the D-backs, Steve Berthiaume, next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Jays back in action tonight against the Diamondbacks. So let's get to know him a little bit better with the play-by-play voice of the D-backs, Steve Berthiaume. He joins us now. Steve, good morning. Thank you for doing this.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here in Toronto. It's one of my favorite stops.
So I know Bob Brenly, your counterpart on the broadcast, didn't play here all that long. Does he have any Toronto spots for you or anything like that?
Well, BB didn't make the trip. He's having his catcher's knees worked on this week, so I'm here with Luis Gonzalez. But
oh, cool!
Yeah, we always joke about trying to get Bob's number 9 retired here when he plays half the season, but we haven't had a lot of luck.
Oh well, we can make that push for you too. We can start campaigning as well.
Yeah, level of excellence. There's space. How's doing the calls with Luis every once in a while? He was a unbelievable playing career. I haven't gotten to hear him with you very much when I tune in.
Yeah, Gonzo's great. He is obviously now retired and has the position of Diamondbacks and Goodwill Ambassador. So Gonzo makes a couple of trips a year and does some TV and does some radio and makes appearances, and he's involved in the front office and well. So he has a lot of responsibilities with the club, but he likes to take time out and enjoy the broadcast, which is always a lot of fun.
Well, listen, Steve, given the way that the last homestand went, it seems like a good time to join the D-backs broadcast. I know that it has been a bit of a streaky season for this team, but what did you see during that homestand that helped the D-backs sort of turn things around again?
Yeah, well, this is a club that's been absolutely devastated by injuries to so many key players on the pitching staff that it looks nothing like the club we thought it would look when we left spring training. But the energy on this last homestand, they went 5-1. They swept Seattle 2-3 from San Diego. The energy was back up. They had a couple of very dramatic wins on the homestand, once against the Mariners, and then Saturday with an amazing ninth inning comeback to beat the Padres. So it's really lifted everyone's spirits with the club, because they were really down with all the devastating injuries we've suffered. Corbin Burns, Tommy John surgery. Now we've lost Justin Martinez to Tommy John surgery. Status is very much up in the air. Jordan Montgomery has had Tommy John earlier this year. There's been a number of key injuries in the bullpen as well. So you're talking about a team that lost two key starters, their two closers, a bunch of other setup guys in the bullpen. And for a while, things were slipping away pretty quickly, but they've bounced back nicely, particularly offensively. Pretty well right now. The defense has been a little bit better. The bullpen has been pieced together. They've added some new pieces back there that seems to keep them at least competitive. So the energy is good. And now it's our longest trip of the year so far. 9 games all in 9 days. We go here, then Colorado, then the White Sox. So, you know, anytime you can play the Rockies and the White Sox, you're optimistic about your chances there. So we've got good energy going into this series against the Blue Jay team that even after getting swept in Philadelphia is playing some very good baseball.
Yeah, that's great to hear that the energy has shifted a little bit because, yeah, that 1-9 stretch in late May there looked a little dicey. And obviously this is a team that started out really well. I can imagine the injuries kind of carry a burden on that group until the wins come around. Given the nature of the National League West and the nature of the National League in general right now, how much do you get the sense that there is a sense of urgency with this group as well? Because unfortunately, fair or otherwise, even with injuries, you can't have two bad weeks in the NL West really because things can get away from you so quickly. Do you sense that urgency with this group as well?
I think there's still some ambiguity with the club, like exactly who are we and what are we, given all the injuries and all the necessary personnel changes on the roster. You're right about the National League West. It is a brutal division. I mean, it is just brutal. But they've very much held their own. They're certainly in the thick of the race in terms of a postseason spot. But I think because of all the changes that have been made necessary, particularly in the pitching staff, I think we're still trying to be, you know, can they get consistent enough to make a run and be somewhere between 5 to 8 games over 500 at the deadline? There's a lot of questions about the Diamondbacks because they have some very talented players headed for free agency. And so I think that there is no team in the majors that could impact the trade deadline more than the Diamondbacks. But right now I think they're very much against the trade deadline. They believe they can back together and compete. And so far they've done that, certainly on the last homestand. So I think it's more a case of trying to figure out, okay, we knew what we thought we were going to be. Now, given the compete, still trying to answer that question. But so far the answer seems to be yes.
Yeah, and listen, it is early. Let's put it like that, right? We still have 6 weeks to go and change until the trade deadline. We have heard general manager Mike Hazen say that he's hopeful that there will be a turnaround. Great start to that turnaround with that homestand. And I'm also wondering, Steve, what you're seeing from the offensive side. That part of it seems to have held sort of its end of the bargain here. What do you make of where the bats are at for this team?
The offense is no doubt about that. Last season, the Diamondbacks scored more runs than any team in the majors. I think we're somewhere in the top 5 or 6 this year, maybe 4, somewhere in there. Been the strength of the club. Gino Suarez is having a tremendous season, homered Saturday and Sunday against San Diego. 21 homers, most on the team, third in the National League. Corbin Carroll's already at 20 home runs for the season. He's only 2 shy of his total from all of last year. Geraldo Perdomo, I think, is one of the most underrated players in the National League, the shortstop. Josh Naylor's been a terrific addition. He's leading the club in hits. And they've pieced together enough offense here and there from other spots to keep it going. But the offense is the strength of the team. They can be a little bit too home run reliant at times, but they can also scratch together some runs late in games like they did Saturday when they came back with that amazing ninth inning to beat San Diego. So they're sort of, it's a little Jekyll and Hyde offensively in the fact that they can hit a bunch of home runs. Sometimes if the home runs aren't there, they struggle. But other times they can get on base, move the runner along, piece together hits 3, 4, 5 in a row, and scratch out some runs that way like they did this weekend. So the offense is the strength of the club. And sometimes it's had to carry the pitching due to the injuries, but they've more than held their own so far this year.
Yeah, it was a lot of names you named there, and the depth is really obvious. 10 of their top 11 players by plate appearances have been league average or better at the plate so far this year. You mentioned Josh Naylor there. I'll dig in on that one for the Canadian content here. Big addition in trade over the summer, and leading the team in hits is really nice. 9 home runs, kind of what we expected. 9 stolen bases already. Has that one surprised you at all?
A little bit, because he's such a smart base runner. I mean, we had Paul Goldschmidt in Arizona for years, and Goldie was one of the smartest base runners I've ever seen, like a really good, sneaky base stealer, not someone you think of as fast. And Josh, in particular, gets tremendous reads. The Diamondbacks' base running coach is Dave McKay, who's probably the best maybe ever, is very strict and tremendous base running coach. And Naylor has a knack for picking up that move, particularly going second and third. Like several times this year, he's suddenly taken off from second base and stolen third easily. He's very good at that. He's a very instinctive base runner, picks up on signs from pitchers, and he's been a really good addition. The defense was a little first in the year, but that's much improved. Diamondbacks for the last three seasons had Christian Walker at first base, three gold gloves. I mean, just sensational. So it's hard to live up to that standard, but Josh has done a nice job. It's remarkable to me how often he swings at the first pitch. He's the most aggressive hitter on the team. He swings at nearly every first pitch he sees. It's become kind of a running joke. But very aggressive hitter. He's done a very nice job, and it's been a very good fit here for sure. He's a great teammate. Seems to get along really well. So he had big shoes to fill in replacing Christian, who was a key part of this club for years and years, and he's done a very nice job here.
When you talk about Naylor, you know, being a sneaky base runner and things along those lines, and then you also talk about the D-backs maybe relying on the home run a little bit too much, Steve, how do you see his value in that sense to maybe diversify the offense a little bit? Because we know he has power, but it's also nice to see, I guess, that other side of his game, right?
Yeah, he's such an interesting hitter because if you go back 2 years ago in Cleveland, he hit 300, more, little over 300. And then last season, 31 homers, 100-plus RBI. So sometimes he's a hitter. Other times he's more of a slugger. This year he's been kind of both, somewhere in the middle, I think, which is where they'd like to see him. Torrey Lovello doesn't want home run hitters. He wants good hitters who hit home runs, and there is a difference. And Naylor, I think, can sort of very uniquely be both at once. And so I think between the sluggers with, you know, Gino Suarez and some others and some of the on-base guys and some of the other guys, Naylor's kind of right in that sweet spot. And I think it's a link between the two identities.
Couple former Jays on this Diamondbacks team as well. Randall Grichuk, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., and then a name that comes up often here. Now, Dalton Varsho is on the IL, so the return for that trade, we won't see them head-to-head this series. But how has Gabriel Moreno's progress been? This is year three for him in Arizona, age 25, when we start to see guys maybe put it together a little bit more. How have things gone for Moreno this year?
Sensational. That trade, I mean, when we first found out that Mike had traded Dalton Varsho, we all went, oh, no. Because, I mean, he was a beloved player in Arizona, drafted by the Diamondbacks, second-round pick. He did a lot of catching when he was here. So everyone thought, oh, my goodness, you can't trade Varsho. But that trade really launched them into the World Series a couple of years ago. That trade changed the face of the club. Gurriel has been outstanding in left field. Very consistent. He's had a very good 6 weeks, and he's played above-average defense. But to your question about Gabby, they're a different team when he's on the field and when he's not on the field. It's very noticeable. He was very much an opposite-field hitter his first couple of years here. This year, he's got a little more pop in the bat. He's pulling the ball a little bit more often. He's hitting the ball with authority to left and left center. He's still a whole-field hitter. He'll go pole-to-pole. But the pull power has been nice to see. And, I mean, he's just great behind the plate. He's got tremendous pop times, quick release, strong arm. He's everything you would want in a franchise catcher. And we're just thrilled to have him. He's been a sensational addition.
And then with Gurriel, Steve, not only is he, you know, having success, he's still doing his thing, his little shenanigans in the dugout, right? And I wonder how much fun you as a broadcaster can have with a player like Gurriel, who just seems to lift the spirits, really, of his team whenever he's around.
Yeah, I think he leads the league in shenanigans. He's a very entertaining guy. Like, you know, everything's purple all the time, shoes, hair, equipment, you name it. And he's very gregarious off the field, always smiling, always joking. He's great with the Latin teammates. He and Eduardo Rodriguez kind of lead the Latin group, and they're a very tight-knit group, not at all clicky. But he really does lift everybody's spirits. They're constantly laughing and joking. And his play, his defense in left field has been really good. He's been a Gold Glove finalist a couple of times. The bat has been very consistent over the last 6 weeks, and he does add all that off-the-field quality. That Varsho trade, that was one of Mike Kaysen's best deals since he's been here. It really did change the team, and it continues to impact the club even going into this series.
And, you know, another name that on offense that you brought up there, Steve, and another guy who's in his third full year now, is Corbin Carroll, and he seems to have unlocked something this year. You mentioned the home run total. He has 20. His career high is 25. What have you seen? What is the step forward that Carroll has taken here?
Well, he had a dramatically altered batting stance over the winter time, and when he showed up this spring, when he stood in the batter's box at the plate, he looked like a completely different hitter physically and mechanically than he had been. 2 years ago, Corbin spent the winter time. He was getting pitched up and in a lot of four-seamers and cutters up and in on the left-hand batter. And we spent a winter time trying to figure out how to hit that pitch. And what happened was he altered his mechanics, so he came out last season with a very dead flat swing. And everything off his bat for 3 months was either a swing and a miss or a pop-up straight up in the air. And he was a very different player, and it went on for months and months and months. And I would ask Torrey Lovello, what are you seeing with Corbin? And Torrey would tell me he's trying to hit a pitch that he can't hit. And so about midway through last season, he abandoned that and went back to his previous approach. And if you look at Corbin's splits first half, second half last year, they are dramatic. I mean, the OPS went up about 350 points after the All-Star break. He was phenomenal the last 3 months of last season. He showed up this year now trying to get the ball up in the air more and hit the ball harder with more authority. And so you'll notice when he steps in the batter's box this week, the bat is very upright. It's very vertical, sometimes pointing back out toward the pitcher's mound. Hands are a lot higher than they have. Very, very altered mechanics. And what's happened is he's created a really nice down angle on the ball. He's attacking the ball down, putting backspin on the ball. It's got a tremendous amount of bat speed, and the ball just goes off the bat to all fields. He can hit the ball out to left field. He can pull the ball deep out to right field. He's become a very different hitter this year. And with that, the strikeout rate has gone up. He's striking out a little bit more often than he always has. But the power coming off the bat has been remarkable. And it's a lot of slug. He's fourth in the National League in home runs right now. He's a very different hitter than he has been. Not getting on base quite as much, so the speed isn't quite the factor that it was. He did have a little bit of a hamstring issue last couple of weeks. That slowed him down just slightly on the bases. But he's leading the majors in triples. He's got 20 home runs. The pop off the bat has been phenomenal. And Corbin is not a big guy. I bantamweight boxers or wrestlers. Mm-hmm. I mean, Corbin is yoked. Like, he's a very strong dude. He's all muscle, but he's a small guy. And you look at him physically and you think, okay, this is a singles hitter. He will hit the ball far. And that's been the big change this year, the power off the bat.
Yeah, the other thing I like about when he shows the power, he has one of the fastest home run trots. So he just like books it around the base. He's not trying to waste anyone's time. Steve, that's a lot of great stuff about everything that's gone well on the offensive side. And they're fourth in runs per game, third in home runs. That's a lot of good stuff. The pitching side has not gone nearly as well. And you got into some of the injury issues that they've had. Corbin Burnes, Justin Martinez, A.J. Puck, a bunch of Jordan Montgomery. So that explains a lot of it. With the guys who are here, we're going to see Brandon Pfaadt today. So he's struggled with some home run issues, a 5.50 ERA. But he's been a little bit better a little bit of late. Eduardo Rodriguez comes off the IL. He's had two better starts since he came back. Are you starting to see a couple of the starters turn the corner here at all, or is it still a little too few games to say that yet?
No, I think we've definitely seen some optimism from the starting pitching for sure. We're still waiting for Zach Gallen to be Zach Gallen. Zach's been very inconsistent this year. He's had some mechanical issues. It's, you know, for Zach, it's one good, one bad, one good, one bad. And in for half of the season was the most reliable starting pitcher in Baxad. He went 5-0 in five starts in April and was sensational. But lately we've seen some more occasional mistakes. I will throw out the ERA. He had one start a couple of times ago against Washington where he did not retire a batter. He got blown up with no outs in the first, so that destroyed the ERA. But he's been better. He beat Seattle last week, pitched very well for five innings. He's getting back to where he was, so there's some optimism there. E-Rod, a month on the injured list with some shoulder inflammation. He's been very good since he came back the last couple of starts. He's not a guy that throws hard. You know, it's 92, 93 top end. He's got to work the lines. He's got to work the edges, but he's done a nice job like that. And for a guy that basically throws 92 miles an hour, gets a ton of swing and miss. So that's been very encouraging. And they've pieced together some other things. They've had some injuries there. Ryan Nelson has moved into a full-time starter spot. And Nelly's got that big-time 97-mile-hour elevated fastball at the top of the zone that's very effective. He's done a really nice job for them. Ryan Nelson was their most consistent starter for the last 3 months of last year. And now he's back in the rotation after working in the bullpen because of the injuries. But we went into spring training thinking, this is almost laughable. We have so much pitching, we don't even know what to do with it all. And then Montgomery went down, Tommy John. Corbin Burns had shoulder trouble, looked good. Suddenly he's got a tear. He just had Tommy John the other day. And then you have two wipeout closers at the back end in A.J. Puck and Justin Martinez. Both of them are gone. Joe Mantiply, who's been a key lefty reliever for the last couple of years, was released. Ryan Thompson has struggled. Kevin Gankel has spent most of the year in the minor leagues. And these are guys that got every big outs at the back end of the bullpen for the last year and a half to get them into the World Series. So the bullpen, the A bullpen, was completely blown up almost as soon as the season started. And then we lost one starting pitcher after another. But they've pieced it together in the rotation. Fought has steadied himself. Erod is back pitching well. Nelson's back in the rotation doing a nice job. Gallen's still not quite where he should be heading into free agency. I think that might be in his head a little bit. So they're doing okay. That's the way I think I would put it. They've come up with a bullpen, added some pieces. From this point on, the rotation is doing okay. It's enough to keep them in games.
Yeah, it's if you ever doubt the platitude that is you can never get too much pitching, just take a look at the D-backs and you'll see what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny because and it's not just us guys either. Like, I look at the Dodgers. The Dodgers have had more pitching injuries than we've had. But, you know, if the Dodgers lose five pitchers to injury, they just go out and buy five more. Mm-hmm. You know, they're kind of a unique case. The Diamondbacks have had to figure things out on the fly here, and it's kept them over 500, and it's kept them in a wild card discussion, and they're right there where they would like to be, maybe not quite as high, but they're ready to make a move here if they can come up with a good road trip. You got 9 games on the road. You go 7-2 on this trip, facing the Rockies and the White Sox, then it's a very different discussion when we get back to Phoenix.
Yeah, we'd be in a pretty comfortable spot in the NL West to make a push here heading into July. Steve, thanks so much for doing this. Looking forward to hopefully seeing you at the ballpark a little bit later.
Oh, that's great. Love Toronto. It's one of my favorite stops. I love the ballpark. It's always fun to come here. So I'm glad we had an off day here yesterday, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Steve Berthiaume, Diamondbacks play-by-play, and on with Luis Gonzalez.
Yes.
For this series, which will be fun to. I mean, I'll be at the ballpark, so I don't know if I'll catch much of it, but it'll be cool to see Gonzo around. I have two other Diamondbacks notes that we didn't get to there, other than just like being fascinated that Shelby Miller's back and good. He mentioned Kevin Ginkle in the bullpen. The Gink has a 12.27 ERA right now. I don't know that is going to resolve things for their bullpen. He came back and immediately gave up a couple of runs to San Diego on the weekend. They're reaching. But there was a name in the dock that we didn't get to that you had put in there in Eugenio Suarez.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
So here's a stat for you.
Please.
So with every home run, obviously people have seen, you know, on StatCast, we can see how many ballparks it's out of, et cetera. So you can go on the leaderboard and you can look at who had the most cheapy home runs, the ones that are only at, you know, the Yankee Stadium special or something like that. You can see who has the most, that's out of a lot of parks, not every park. And then you can see who has the most, they call them no doubters, home runs that would be out of every single park in baseball.
Yep.
Eugenio Suarez leads the league. More than Judge and Cal Raleigh, he has 15 of his 28 bombs are absolutely no doubt, 15 of his 21 bombs are absolutely no doubt out of here.
I believe that. He keeps doing it. You know, this is nothing new. He's 33 now, but he's been doing it for a long time, and he's done it with several teams. It's just so impressive. Honestly, it's so impressive when a guy can maintain that level of production throughout his career. You know, not unique in any way. Like, you can look at other guys and make the same case here. But I really love watching Suarez hit, especially because of that. Because it's just so, the power is just so absurd. It's beautiful to watch.
They call them no doubters for a reason, because there is no doubt when he gets a hold of one that it's leaving the park. We'll see if the Blue Jays can get back on track and hit some homers of their own. Brandon Pfaadt will start tonight. He has given up a lot of them. He comes in with a 5.50 ERA and an underlying expected ERA based on strikeouts and walks and quality of contact of over 7. So this is a guy, he was like a buzzy, like end of last year. If you're a fantasy player heading into this year, he was an interesting name because the stuff is good. Last year, the underlying stuff was actually saying he actually was unfortunate. He should have been a 3.5, high 3s ERA guy. Not so this time. His strikeout rate has plummeted. The quality of stuff by the pitch design metrics has dropped off. And yeah, a guy you can get some home runs against. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays. Comes in with a 94-mile-an-hour fastball. He'll throw sweeper, sinker, and then if you are a lefty, you'll get changeup and curveball as well. And he is, of course, a righty. The Blue Jays will see 5 of 6 righties throughout the course of this homestand, or this week's part of the homestand. So yeah, be pretty interesting. On the other side, it's Chris Bassitt, who I feel like I don't even need to do the Chris Bassitt little scouting report stuff, because everyone just knows Chris Bassitt so well at this point.
At this point, I think so. The one thing I guess to mention is that Eugenio Suarez has indeed homered off of Chris Bassitt. So.
Yeah. Well, Suarez will do that at times. Fun show today.
Yeah.
Especially given that there was no game to talk about last night. But we got Shohei, we got Yankees, we got ALE stuff, MLB Draft Combine. We did it all. Tomorrow we'll have a fun one as well. We'll break the game down. Madison Chipman is going to join us in studio for an hour. We'll talk to Clint Yates. Thanks to Shai Davidi, Dan Zimborski, Anthony Castro-Vince, and Steve Berthume for joining us. Thanks to Ahmed Austin and Jennifer behind the glass. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a wonderful Tuesday.